past year and a half, the FOMC has been gradually increasing its target range for the federal funds rate as the economy has continued to make progress toward our goals of maximum employment and price stability. The economy is doing well, is showing resilience. Overall, we continue to expect that the economy will expand at a moderate pace over the next few years. We expect that the job market will strengthen somewhat further. We expect inflation to remain low in the near term. When our securities holdings begin to gradually decline, so too will the supply of reserve balances in the banking system. It'll be like watching paint dry, that this will just be something that runs quietly in the background.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the big surprise on Friday, well, shouldn't be a secret, Amazon is getting into the food business with a purchase of Whole Foods. Boy, is this going to revolutionize the grocery food business. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Robin Griffith will be joining me. He's still bullish. He says, don't fight the uptrend despite the valuations. But he said, you know, this thing may last maybe another month, but he sees a pattern as we head into the fall, very similar to the crash of 1987. He said the markets are very vulnerable to an 87-type crash. He'll be here to talk about it. He's got two areas that he thinks are good long-term investments. He'll be here in Hour 1. Also joining me will be Ned Schmidt as we take a look at the ag sector. You wouldn't see it in some of these fertilizer stocks, but the grains are breaking out to new high records as animal protein bull market begins, because if it's beef, chicken, or pork, they're fed grains, and grains are the hottest thing around with strong demand coming out of Africa and Asia. He'll be here to talk about that. And of course, Ryan Poplava on what drove the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. Well, it happened this week. The Fed decided they were going to raise interest rates again. Third time in a row, second time this year. I don't think it surprised anybody, but at least we've got that beyond us. So when we talk about the Fed removing the punch bowl, exactly what do we mean? Because right now we have the opposite of what you think would be causing them to do what they're doing. We have a slowing economy and falling inflation. So the real question is the Fed going to be able to normalize monetary policy like they are saying, because things seem a little strange. As a matter of fact, it looks like, if you look at interest rates now, Germany's at only 0.25%, while we're at 2%, a little over 2%. Reminds you of the days of the 1970s when Fed Chair Paul Volcker was raising rates and we had a big spread between the U.S. and Europe. So what does all of this mean, then, that we're headed in this direction? And second of all, several of our technicians have acknowledged that we're starting to see divergences in the stock market. And when divergence abounds, there is something afoot. So if there is trouble down the line, where is it going to surface first? All of that subject of conversation today on The Big Picture on the Financial Sense News Hour right here. And on over to the other side of the desk here first, because we go to Ryan Poplava. Welcome back as we attempt and endeavor to piece together the catalysts and drivers that move the financial markets over the last week. And last week, if you remember, Ryan, we left off the Fabulous Five. We're taking it on the chin, and that really seemed to spill over into this week. A positioning was starting to get a little extreme in those areas, and they've performed already so well over the last 5 months. Well, maybe it was time for a breather. And I guess the concern since then has been that will the leadership weakness spill over now into other areas? That's the concern.
And the million-dollar question, John.
Ta-da-da.
I told our office on Monday, I was doing some technical work, that the real focus need not be on the tech. Yes, that's kind of the shot across the bow that we got on Friday. But really, hey, if everyone's going to start to get this risk off mentality, you're going to see it in treasuries. So I said, let's look at that 10-year treasury yield and see what's going on there. You know, if we were going to see a true flight to safety, you know, I was looking at the rotation that was starting to happen. You know, banks and energy did well on Friday. They also did well on Monday. But like I said, I wanted to see, was it just going to another sector, another industry group, or is it going to truly in a risk-off area? Because that's what would happen if we were looking at something that was more intermediate-term oriented for a correction. And Chris Poplava, our CIO, I was talking to him, seeing if we were doing any changes based on that, and he said, yes, they started moving our weight in technology from, it was overweight at the time, to market weight very early in this process on Friday and also on Monday as a result of what we saw going on in technology stocks. But like I said, where was that going? Was it going to treasuries? No, we saw that going towards value. We started seeing a lot of technicians, a lot of strategists coming out with newsletters earlier this week talking about a move towards value, recommending value. So we did make some of those moves ourselves. But, you know, what we did see in treasuries Wednesday, that was definitely something different and obviously something that we should probably focus on somewhat this week.
Well, if we look at treasuries, I have to ask why they rallied on Wednesday. I mean, let's face it, everybody was expecting the Fed to raise rates, which they did.
Yeah, they did. Consumer price index came out on Wednesday morning, right before the market opened, I believe. It was released very early, showing a drop of 0.1% in May, mainly due to energy. But even if you remove food and energy, it was only up like 0.1%. So barely any movement in inflation. So year over year growth on inflation in May was 1.9%, well below, obviously, the Fed's target of 2%, and definitely off where it was in April, around 2.2% year over year. So the Fed's target, like I said, 2%. Many anticipated that the recent trend in CPI would kind of cause the Fed officials to kind of reconsider their strict monetary policy path of increasing rates three times this year. And the dot plot came out later on that day from the Fed showing that they're also anticipating raising it three times next year. You know, the other number released on Wednesday was the retail sales figures, and those weren't good either. Down 0.3% in May, despite the tightness in the labor market and rising wages. So, you know, take those together and all the economic data, in addition to the big drop in crude Wednesday, due to a bearish 2017 IEA report suggesting U.S. supply could taper off if oil hit 40, and a smaller than expected draw on inventories. And, you know, you take those economic figures, the CPI, the retail sales, disappointing, crude dropping quite a bit on Wednesday below some near-term support. And you had a pretty decent deflationary recipe all in one day.
Okay, well, do you feel that this is a recipe for the top? What do you think?
Well, we think there's still enough earnings power and possible reflationary stimulus down the pipe with the tax reform bill we think will eventually make it through Congress. I think everybody can agree mostly on tax reform, even if it is just taking from one area and giving to another. Though we think it's nowhere near what the market was expecting back in November after Trump was elected. Remember all the celebration in the markets at that time. The Fed is still accommodative, but when they switch to a much more hawkish tone, maybe talking about asset bubbles becoming a concern, then we'll get a little bit more concerned about monetary policy. But, you know, the market isn't just a U.S. market. We've shifted 24% of our equity positions to overseas, where we see the business cycle in an earlier phase than we do here. Valuations are more attractive and monetary policy is more accommodative. So yes, do I think this is a top? No, it was just a short-term correction. I think it was, if you look at the New York Stock Exchange Composite Index, dropped only 2 days in the last seven. So is that a recipe for a top? No, not quite. Since technology was leadership, was it the shot across the bow? Maybe on valuations, and it should give most people crowding those areas a little bit of a pause, I would think. And then also, look at Bitcoin this week. Huge precipitous correction from like 3,000 almost to 2,000. You know, these were momentum areas, a bunch of crowding going on there. Definitely a short-term top there. But a lot of people that have been talking about those areas in the media consider it a short-term buy. But overall, you know, like I said, we have been moving our U.S. equity position overseas. and we continue to do more in that area. We had actually Vanguard come into our office this week. We had a discussion with them, what they're seeing, and they were saying the same thing. They're actually a lot more positioned overseas. And when they go to other advisors out there, other professional managers, they're seeing it out there that not many are positioned that way and going more overseas. So they're crowding that area right now. Everyone's crowding tech. They're crowding overseas. And we've been moving over in that area as well. But, you know, the Bank of Japan announced this week, and it intends to stay ultra loose until 2% inflation is achieved and price growth stays stably. And then looking at other monetary policy overseas, you know, still very accommodative.
Well, since we're on the subject of monetary policy, the Federal Open Market Committee announced its policy decision this last Wednesday, as we were talking about, with another hike. And this is the third hike in as many quarterly sessions. Now, they also announced plans to shrink their balance sheet of long-term bonds, which also has an impact on monetary policy. Are they moving forward with their plans to continue tightening policy with inflation below their target?
Yeah, they did announce that hike. They are moving forward. Their dot plot, which essentially is where each member estimates where interest rates are going to be at the end of the year and of next year and so on and so on. They're expecting three hikes this year, so one more, and then three hikes next year. You know, Janet on Wednesday said the setting is here for inflation to go up, given, you know, where unemployment is very low. But in my opinion, it has been stubborn due to energy, which is a very large component of inflationary pressures in the CPI, et cetera. But, you know, the FOMC did, however, change their language around inflation with the statement, near-term risks to the economic outlook appear roughly balanced, but the committee is monitoring inflation developments closely. So even though they haven't really focused too much on the yield curve, there has been really no discussion about that. I think if they did, we would have seen a nice lift in financials. You know, I'm sure they have it under a microscope, as you mentioned that they've announced their plans for phase three of their normalization process this week. They actually did in the minutes from the last meeting, and basically they have announced how they actually intend to shrink their balance sheet. So it wasn't just like, hey, we're going to discuss it at the next meeting. No, they said, this is our plan. And their plan is to cap off a certain amount of treasuries and a certain amount of mortgage-backed securities and agency debt each month from maturing. And those caps will grow each quarter, starting from $10 billion total in the first month and tapering up. So quantitative tightening here up to around $50 billion total towards the end of that expansionary plan. And the Fed's balance sheet right now is around a $4.5 trillion. And I was just taking a look, about $1.4 trillion just in treasuries is expected to mature in the next 5 years. So, you know, the treasury is going to continue to produce some supply. What's happening here is that we're going to have a curb in demand. And my guess is we'll see a pause in rate hikes maybe next September. But I think we'll actually see the Fed implement the strategy they just announced to shrink their balance sheet. They said they're going to do it this year. And then I think they may or may not, you know, depending on economic activity, raise in December. But, you know, my guess is focusing on their balance sheet, they hope to change investor sentiment at the long end of the curve. Like I said, they didn't mention the yield curve, but I know they've got to be focusing on it because it's flat right now. And maybe see some selling pressure as sentiment by investors, by large firms, institutions kind of shift towards, hey, the Fed's just going to keep backstopping, you know, bonds at this point. No, they're going to start tapering. And that could change the sentiment there. But, you know, they won't if economic conditions don't improve. The big curveball for the economy now is then what can Congress and Trump get done on the fiscal front?
Yeah, and they're going to need to get the ball rolling on this, because if you look at it, August is just around the corner and Congress goes on recess for a month and they come back into session on September 5th. President Trump and the Republicans have had a lot of political currency from investors since the beginning of the year, but who knows where that is going to be if they begin to see that there really isn't any more progress on the reflationary front by then. So it seems like there's a clock ticking on a whole series of different issues, political and economic. Okay, Ryan, any other important economic data points this week besides the CPI? And do remember to include in this, what do you see on the horizon for investors next week?
Data for manufacturing did improve with some announcements this week. We got the surveys on June activity by the Empire Manufacturing Survey and the Philly Fed surveys, both showing quite a bit of surprise and improvement there. But housing that was out on Friday and, yes, earlier in the week, inflation, both of those have disappointed. And I mentioned last week, it would be a good idea to take a look at the overall economic outlook just to see, you know, if there has been some improvement from Q1, because we need to see it. So I headed over to the Atlanta Fed site where they have their GDP Now model. Anybody can go there. Just take a look. GDP Now model. Everybody should have that. It's a great indicator of where the consensus is on GDP and what the Atlanta Fed and their modeling economic work, where they see things. And right now, they just lifted it up this week to 3.2% based on earlier data in the week. But that was without the housing data, which some of the construction information there does affect GDP. The median forecast outside the Fed is right now is right around 3%. So the Fed modeling right around 3%, the median forecast right about the same. That would be a nice uptick, you know, from the revised GDP figure for Q1. But moving on to next week, John, there will be some May-end earnings from Lennar, Adobe, FedEx, and Red Hat. But other than that, I think the Flash Purchasing Managers Index information will be very helpful to see. That will be announced on Friday for the U.S. and Europe. We don't get China's till the end of the month. But part one of the U.S. bank stress tests will come out on Thursday. And there's been, you know, obviously a lot of decent attention on that area with the rally on Friday and Monday in the last week. So that should be interesting to note. Monday, the UK and the EU will be discussing Brexit, and an EU leader summit will commence on Thursday and Friday. So could be some headlines at that point. Housing stocks. Now, like I said, Lennar will be announcing next week. I was looking at the index this week, broke out to the upside, but did weaken a little bit on that housing data on Friday. So Lennar's earnings should shed more light on that area if traders are focusing there.
Well, it's always interesting, as I always say. The Fed decision is now, of course, out of the way, and we have more economic and earnings information coming around the corner in July, which isn't too far away for us right now. So we'll see where all of this heads. But like I said before, it seems like the Trump administration and other factors are running up against a clock right now, because, you know, as well as I do, we had all this euphoria after the Trump election, and you know, people are always disappointed by Washington, because it's like trying to turn a ship with a little rudder. You know, whenever you try to change direction, make reforms, put things right, it just takes an agonizing amount of time to get through the machinery. And I think that's what they're watching right now and saying, well, are you going to do this or you're not going to do it? You know, so, but that's just the way Washington's all, you know, it's governments all around the world. We're not the only one.
Right. And given that if maybe investors don't see the progress that we should expect from obviously the Republicans being both a majority in the Congress and also with someone in the White House, if you don't have that movement, we could get a backlash with midterm elections coming up 2018.
No, I agree with that. Okay. We will see you again next week. Appreciate it, Ryan Poplava.
No problem, John. Talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
What you need at this point for the markets to sell off is obviously for liquidity to be drained away one way or the other. And this can only happen, in my view, in one of three ways. The first is central banks decide to meaningfully shrink their balance sheets. Now, of course, we've had the Fed signal that they were going to be doing that come the end of the year. But as the Fed starts to do that, you still have the BOJ, you still have the ECB continue to inject liquidity. So I think until you get a meaningful reduction in liquidity injections from all central banks, it's hard to imagine markets crashing. That's your first possibility.
Well, it seems like every single week we come on the air and we tell you, Well, the markets are at another record, and we saw that again this week. Joining me on the program is Robin Griffiths. And Robin, I want to begin the last time we spoke several months ago. You were very, very bullish on the market. And of course, we've seen new highs since then, whether you're looking at the S&P or especially the blue chip Dow Industrials. So you still hold those thoughts?
I do. On my work, equity markets were not a good place to be right up until Donald became president of America. Because even in the markets where the equity markets were rising, which included Britain and America, the government bond market was outperforming equities. And that meant, in theory, you were taking more risk than you needed to get a lower return than you could have got if you bought the equities. That was even in the markets where the equities were going up. And in plenty of other markets, the market wasn't even rising anyway. However, the day that Donald got elected, American stock market took off like a rocket. And for a while, it looked like just a U.S. affair. But since then, lots of other markets have now followed America. When I rank them all into my quintile system, which is all asset classes ranked in descending order of merit from very strong, strong, neutral, weak, and very weak, but all of the top quintile and the top half of the second quintile are all equity markets at this moment. That hasn't happened for quite a while. However, there is a yes, but right in the top quintile is the World Index. I use the FT, but you could use the Morgan Stanley. The Global Index, be a passive holding, the Global Index is actually quite hard to beat. There are markets beating it. And those markets are actually India, China, and emerging markets. Britain, America, and Japan actually come in the second quintile. Our markets are strong, but they're not as strong as a passive holding, if you like, a Vanguard holding of the World Index. So on my work, in the West, we're not entitled to be as excited and pleased with ourselves as all that. But we should have been making more money elsewhere. The second bit, which is more specifically American, that it causes me some concern, is that, as we know, there are a very few giant blue chips which are not only holding America up, but making the index very strong. And with its FANG, Facebook, Amazon, Nextbook, Google, and Tesla, and those sorts of things, that's what's really been where most of the action is. The broader indices, they're strong, but they're not as strong as all that. And I'm a little concerned that the focus is too narrow at the moment. It doesn't alter the fact that the trend on the chart is definitely upwards, though. And the fact that it happens to be expensive, we still have to go with the trend, yes, but it's going up, so it's going to get more expensive.
Robin, usually during market tops, as investors get a little bit more cautious, money tends to gravitate into the blue chips versus, let's say, the small cap stocks. Does this disparity between the blue chips, which are hitting new records, and, let's say, the Russell 2000, which doesn't seem to be going anywhere, does that concern you?
Yeah, it does. Because, you see, we've seen this movie before. And it's not the movie that ends and they all live happily ever after. That was Snow White. This one can have a bumpier ending than that. The second piece which causes me great caution is this demographic factor. The retiring baby boomers, people my age, are scaling down on their houses, their condos and everything else, even their yachts. And their consumption isn't going to drive any great boom. And, of course, the next generation is being half the size. It's going to find when they want to buy a house, there'll be at least two, possibly three offered to them. So that's what is certainly not going to be a seller's market. And now that we've got to a state where the Fed are admittedly very cautiously creeping interest rates back up again, this combination puts a squeeze on. But at some point, it's going to stop the uptrend. On my work, the seventh year of a decade, especially the second half of it, is if you were ever going to take a bit of risk off the table, that's when you would do it. What I've been saying to people is don't fight the uptrend just because it's expensive. Go with it. And you're probably okay till at least the end of July, so a little bit more longer than here. But August, September into October, I would not want to be fully invested in that period. I see the risk as being quite similar to 1987, when nothing went wrong in 1987. We were right in the early stages of a secular uptrend, which ran all the way through from 1982 to the year 2000. And yet, you could come in one day and the market's down 25%, and it takes a while to figure out how the hell did that happen. I think we are actually vulnerable to some sort of correction of that type. And then the second part is that once you've had a correction, the rest of the decade through to about 2020 doesn't look as though the economy is going to be booming. The early economic indicators, the ones that have quite a good track record, are starting to say it's not bad, but it's starting to slow down now. Now, that slowing down is not the same as going into recession. There's no sign of a recession yet, but there is a sign of a definite topping out and a rolling over. These are matters of concern to me, I have to say.
So when you see these kind of trends, and one thing that came out this week with the Fed raising interest rates, they are now talking about shrinking their balance sheet, Robin. And as you know what that means, they are going to be withdrawing liquidity. So they're taking some of the alcohol out of the punch bowl.
Yes, I agree. From a long-term point of view, they're doing the right thing. I mean, it was concerning that they'd allow their balance sheet, and it isn't just the Fed, it's other central banks as well, have built up their balance sheets to dangerously large levels. The other two that are enormous are the Bank of Switzerland and the Bank of Japan as well. In their own stock market, they're also huge holders of equities. In a sense, it's as though central banks have decided free capitalist markets are far too dangerous. We can't allow them to work. We have to decide when we're going to let them down slowly. So we've got manipulated markets, not free capitalist markets, really. And that, again, history shows that you've got to get to the end of that process. It usually takes a bit of a bump to get it down there, basically. And if the P/E ratios were lower than they are, I wouldn't be worried. But as you know, the P/E ratios have only ever been higher than they are right now, twice in history, 1929 and at the dot-com bubble peak. And just because we have been up to those extreme highs doesn't mean we've got to go there again. And I think central banks, including the Fed, taking the punch bowl away, or as you say, putting more water in it, is the right thing to do. And they obviously know they've got to do it very, very slowly. Because if they hike rates quickly, they would put a lot of mortgages underwater and that would crash the property market. And they clearly want to only let it down gently rather than crash it. But it's a negative influence, isn't it?
Let's talk about another market that has been breaking out and has been a laggard for so long, and that's the international markets. What's your view on international stocks and markets compared to, let's say, the overpriced U.S.?
Yeah, well, my what you might call slam dunk, the one I like the best, is the world's largest democracy, which incidentally, ethnically, there are more Indians now than even Chinese by many counts. Ethnically, that includes what is Pakistan and Bangladesh. But their demographic position is incredibly healthy. They are a democracy, and they've got, under Mr. Modi, the Indian Prime Minister, is doing all the right things. The Indian economy is now growing at 7.2%. Some people are a little disappointed it's not 10 already, but the man's only been in power 3 years. He's got longer before another election comes up, and he's quite likely to win a second term. So I can actually see the Indian economy compounding at a rate between 7 and 10% for probably another decade. And that will take the market very high. Also, I think we foreigners underown a market like India. It's already the sixth biggest stock market on the planet. By 2020, it's going to overtake Great Britain. And in 30 years' time, it will be right up there. It'll be America, China, and India will be the three giant economies. So one needs to own a piece of this. It's not dirt cheap, but it's seen as the premium rated market of Asia. And I think it will hold a premium rating. I think it will fluctuate in the range between about 18 times earnings when it's relatively depressed and about 25 when it's a bit more euphoric. The day Mr. Modi got elected, it got up to 30 times earnings, but that wasn't sustainable. But in this range, I would buy dips. We last had a dip in India when he demonetized 500 and 1,000 rupee notes, which is to get rid of corruption. That hit is now history. We're through it. We made a new all-time high breakout. My next target for the Sensex index is 35,000, and I would buy it all the way up to there, and then I would stand back a little bit. But it's a buy-on-dip market, and if I have to name a single market to hold for, you know, a pension plan type of length of time, that would be my best one. And we overseas people should increase our weighting there. China is also strong, but I am concerned that China, firstly, it isn't a democracy, and the credit bubble in China, well, if it was a democracy, they wouldn't be able to do what they're doing now, but they've got it up to numbers which are really quite scary. However, for as long as the regime in China is in control, and it jolly well is in control, I don't think it's going to suddenly go pear-shaped on us. So China and China-related markets also look good. The final bit of overseas investment, which is very exciting, it's nothing to do with Britain and Europe and Brexit and all of that. It's industrial metals. The whole commodity space is not looking strong at all, particularly energy. I think that's coming down and food is not. But industrial metals are now in the very early stages of a new secular uptrend. They've had a six-year, very painful bear market. They've got down to almost bankruptcy levels for many of the leading players in it. But the corner is turned. They're now in this early upstage. And what it's all about is infrastructure projects, which are going to use up these industrial metals. And I'm not talking about Mr. Trump's infrastructure projects, although they're real enough. I'm talking about the new Silk Road, as China calls it, which is easily the biggest infrastructure project the planet has ever seen. As you know, the Great Wall of China is not, in fact, visible from space. All 16 pieces of it, totaling 21,000 kilometers, are not visible from space. But this new Silk Road is so big, it will be visible from space. And for the next 2 decades, it will use up an awful lot of copper, nickel, zinc, and eventually steel as well. So I think that the companies that mine these metals, the ones that have now survived, I think you're going to find them on an altogether better wicket than they've been in the past. There was also a period when China, before it went ahead with this huge project, it's warehoused a lot of metal. And for the last couple of years, we found metals simply coming out of warehouses, so the price wasn't strong. But now they've got the warehouses empty enough, they're going to need to start mining more. And that's obviously very positive. Not connected with this, the other set of metals, which are very, very strong, are clearly lithium, and the other metals that go with battery technology, which includes cobalt, which is roughly trebled. And of course, everybody knows the Tesla story, and most of the other major makers of motor cars all know how to make electric cars too. It's really the planet switching over from burning fossil fuels to much cleaner, newer technologies, which involve batteries which are really light and really work, and with these other metals. And clearly, it's not so much that lithium is in short supply. It's the actual ore body is extraordinarily plentiful in the world. In fact, after helium and hydrogen, it's the third most plentiful element in all creation. That's where it comes on the atomic table. But once you've got the ore body, that's just mining. To make it into a useful amount of lithium to go into a battery, you need some chemistry. And there is a shortage of the chemical plants that make the ore body going from about 1% lithium to the 99.7% lithium that you need to put it inside a lithium-ion battery. So that's where the shortages will come from. And people who've got permission to do this chemistry, which is not environmentally friendly, of course, and places where they can do that, they will be on a very strong wicket. I think there are one or two places in America, but the big ones are all in China. So the Western world mustn't find itself falling behind China in its ability to make the lithium for lithium-ion batteries, the demand for which is just going to be enormous as we go forward from here. So that's the other area, apart from mainly India, that I really do like overseas.
And speaking of metals, let's talk about gold, which has had a series of higher highs, but almost looks like a double top. Does it break out in this period of time, Robin, or let's say as we head into the fall and we see some turbulence in the market, could gold have a catalyst at that point?
It could. On my ranking system, it comes well lower than the equity market and the industrial metals. But it is a precious metal, so I include silver here. They are more attractive than cash, but they're about neutral on my ranking system. I actually own some gold, but at the moment, if you take a ruler and connect it to the old all-time high of about 6 years ago and draw that line down, that line was briefly broken the other day, well, about a week ago. If we were to make a pattern of rising highs and lows above that line now, that certainly would get me up to about 1380, 1400 sort of level. Only if we can go above there, suddenly my ranking system would make gold look really very hot indeed. There's another thing, though. Gold is slightly expensive as a commodity, so it's all clearly already being ranked as money to some extent. When I compare the value of gold to the cheapness or dearness of mining companies that mine gold, the mines are much better value. So at the moment, somebody who is optimistic about gold for the longer term, because I'm sure you're right, if we get any kind of meltdown generally, gold and silver will do well then, you'd probably do better now buying the mining companies of gold. There's definitely a pickup in value there, probably about 30% more to be had that way. So I actually own a bullion position, and I would only cut it if it fell back below $1,200 an ounce. If it fluctuates like it is, I'm reasonably optimistic that it will go at least up to about $1,400 this year. If, however, we actually get a 1987-style panic in markets, and normally you would expect people would buy the dollar on that, but if in fact they say, oh, I'm not going to buy the dollar, I'm worried about the dollar, then they would buy the precious metal. Then you could get it breaking 1400, and you could get a really powerful move in gold. That is certainly a possibility. I'm open to that possibility, but I don't think it's a prediction yet. It's a possibility.
So if something like that happens, let's just say we get a 1987 type correction, the market starts to panic. Robin, do you think we could ever see the numbers that we saw reached in 2011 when silver got up to 50 and gold to 1900? Or is that too far out in the distance?
I think that's entirely possible. Definitely possible. And of course, as a technician, the old all-time high is resistance. So to go through there would take a new thing. But getting up to there is relatively easier to do. I'd almost say if it goes above 1400, it would go to 1900. I don't see a problem with that. And silver would go at a leverage rate to gold, roughly 1.5 times, I would have thought at least. So a silver-related stock could be in a very good position. I think they're such an interesting speculation. It's well worth having a small position now, basically.
So right now, you would continue with the trend, and it looks like the blue chip stocks are leading that trend. But maybe this only goes on for maybe another month or so. But as we head into fall, might want to take some cover and shelter.
That's right. You see, the other thing that would happen is after the Fed has hiked rates, if there were a meltdown, it would be in a position to say, well, at least temporarily we could lower them back down again to help you guys out again. So you would find at that stage, nearer the fall, that government bonds look like a haven again, at least in the short term.
Robin, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
We have a website called Global Investment Roadmap. com. There's a lot of stuff on there. There are actually newsletters, although my main newsletter is written for large institutional investors. There is a smaller version that's available for private individuals. If you go onto that website, they can get the product there.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Kevin Matsukato. He is a certified specialist in emergency. He is with Kuakina Corporation. Kevin, let's talk about something that we don't like to think about, and that is a disaster. I know, living here in Southern California for three decades, it was something I never thought about until 2007, when over 600,000 people were evacuated out of the city. And thank goodness I had gone through your emergency prepared work, because I was prepared. So let's talk about why somebody should be prepared.
Exactly. During those wildfires, I firsthand experienced the wildfires when I was working at the Scripps Health. There are certain things that we should be prepared for during any disaster preparedness like that. Emergency resources may be limited around your community. It helps you and those around you survive those type of crisis situations. And mainly, if you're prepared for these type of crises, it reduces fear and anxiety. So a lot of times what we need to get informed of is disaster planning. You want to have your family members make a plan. That's a great start. Then you come up with an assembly of a disaster kit, and I'll explain a little bit more about that. And then when you have the plan and the disaster kit, you want to make sure that you maintain your plans and your kit.
Well, the commodity markets have not been doing well, unless you're looking at certain commodities. Joining us on the program is Ned Schmidt. And Ned, let's begin with the ag sector, because you have some of the ag stocks that either provide fertilizer or seed have not done well. And then you take a look at equipment makers that are just, you know, hitting new records. So what's going on in this sector to explain this disparity?
Well, agricultural commodities are in a full-blown bull market. They're, on average, from their 52-week lows, I follow 19 of them, they're up 35%, and they've been just smoking hot. Right now, we have 9 of 18 that I've followed for a long time, that have hit 52-week highs in the last 3 weeks. Corn, U.S. cash corn, hit a 52-week high last Friday. Wheat is smoking hot. There's just not enough good quality, high protein wheat to go around. Your favorite, Jim, beef hit a 52-week high. Broilers, butter, pork did it yesterday. Both pork and hogs hit 52-week highs yesterday. There is just incredible global demand for these commodities. And every bull market is different. And that's why so many people on the street have missed it, because they were watching corn and soybeans. That's where the last bull was. This bull has been in animal proteins. The seven animal proteins are up 65% from their lows. It's just amazing what is happening to these global prices.
These prices are escalating like this. Is this coming from increased demand, a shortage of production? What is creating this?
Increased demand. And what's being missed by many people in commodities and in oil, Jim, is that developing nation demand for commodities is exploding. The hottest market for corn is Africa and Southeast Asia. And the demand coming out of these developing nations is just faster and stronger than anybody believes. And then we have individual situations like in beef. In beef, we exported this week the first beef to China in 14 years. Donald Trump has done more for agricultural exports since January than the last two presidents combined. So we're going to export beef to China. Now, where do you get beef? You feed it a lot of corn. The corn demand is going to go up strong. Then we have India, which is effectively stopping the beef slaughter industry in India. India is the number one beef exporter in the world. They're 20% of the beef exports. And effectively, there'll be no beef imports from India going forward. And we're going to see the whole 20% of global beef exports are disappear. I don't know how the world does that.
So you can see it in some of the equipment stocks that have been on fire, but why haven't the fertilizer or the other parts of the sector been doing well then?
Okay. The tractor stocks, Deere and AGCO, the street has been using them for a proxy for what's going on. And I think they're going to be disappointed because while tractor sales are up, the mix is not good. In other words, the small tractors under 40 horsepower is a strong market. Large tractors over 100 horsepower, which is Deere's bread and butter, are down 20% from a year ago. So I think they're going to be disappointed in profits. So I'm going to be very careful buying for those. Fertilizer stocks. There is no more misunderstood concept than fertilizers. An acre of dirt that's going to be planted in corn or soybeans or whatever needs a certain amount of fertilizer, no matter what the price is. If the price of soybeans went to $40 a bushel, it's not going to change the right amount of fertilizer for the ground. Price doesn't determine how much fertilizer people use. It's the plant and the dirt that determine it. And what the fertilizer industry did 10 years ago was begin a cycle of building too many processing plants. There's no worldwide shortage of fertilizer. We got plenty of it. But we built too many processing plants to mine it and process it. That cycle is over. And as you look out, 2 years, say, the fertilizer profits are going to be better. And so I would still stay away from fertilizer stocks as a play. The one that's attractive is Agrium, AGU, because they have the largest retail farm store operation in the world, in North America, South America, and Australia. That's where you get the value added, where you come in and talk to a technician, and they specifically figure out what mixes of fertilizer and types you need, and what specific kinds of pesticides you need. So that one's interesting, Agrium. It is merging with Potash. It looks now like August. And fortunately, Agrium's management is going to run the company. But it's interesting because of this farm service and store operation that adds value to the fertilizers. The two stocks that are fundamentally the best is BG and ADM. And they're not particularly cheap, but they're cheaper than everything else. And sometime between now and 1st of August would probably be a very good time to look at those stocks. As once we get into the fall, I think they're going to be already up in anticipation of export sales.
So, Ned, let's move on to another sector. And let's talk about oil, which runs the world. And it was thought by the time we got into the second half of the year that inventory levels would be coming down. Instead, shale production in the U.S. has escalated, so it's given OPEC a run for the money. Let's talk about oil and then also about gold itself in this market.
Oil is an interesting situation because the price is being damaged by short-term considerations. I mean, we've had over 100,000, or in the process of having, about 125,000 barrels a day come on in shale production. That has been known for a year. That's coming out of the Permian Basin and Eagle Ford and down in Texas. Everybody knew that was going to happen. Only some traders were shocked by it. In the second half of the year, and in particularly in 2018, the world will be back in deficit oil production. Demand will be greater than supply. And part of that is due to 2016 was the worst oil discovery year. The chart didn't go back far enough to really determine it, but I would guess in 20 years. We only discovered through conventional drilling 2.6 billion barrels of oil last year. That is the worst year in two decades. Now, what does that mean? 2.6 billion, we use 100 million barrels a day. So we only basically found 26 days of oil last year. So the whole situation is going to change as we move toward next year. And again, the reason for that is developing nations. The number of cars being added in India, the number of cars being added in Africa, the economic development in India. These developing nations are not trying to use less oil like we do. Their goal is economic development, and they're using more of it. And one of the other benefits in this, Jim, is ethanol may get a second second life next year. So this whole oil and fuel situation is going to change somewhat for the world. Because of the shale oil situation, the U.S. oil prices might be the weaker sector.
So let's move on to gold now, because as I look at a chart of gold, we've had a series of higher highs. But we haven't had that breakthrough, Ned, through 1,400 levels, even though, and I don't know if that's because central banks or at least the Fed is raising interest rates, but we haven't been able to break through that. So what's your take on gold? What is a catalyst that's going to drive it?
1,300 is the important price level. And we got to 1,296 on an intraday basis. In the last three FOMC announcements, 2016, that was a bottom in gold. Gold has moved up strongly from every FOMC announcement, including the March one. And so the low we had this week on the FOMC announcement, which is really good for gold, that was the best thing we could have heard out of them for gold. The gold is already outperforming the S&P 500. GLD is up 8.9%. this year. S&P 500 is only up 8.4%. So we've got an excellent buying point. It's outperforming. This FOMC announcement, Jim, is devastating to the NASDAQ 100. That's why the tech stocks are getting killed, because people that understand what the Federal Reserve's doing know that this is going to devastate the NASDAQ 100. And gold is going to become the asset of choice, because stock market returns, which have been driven by tech stock, are going to be ultra miserable. And so the FOMC announcement bolsters the case for gold. And other interesting aspect is the dollar did not rally a bit on this announcement. Every previous announcement, the dollar has rallied, and it has not. In fact, it's failed. It's hitting lows against currencies that really make you wonder what's going on. I mean, the Chinese yuan is probably the currency to watch right now. It's at the highest level since November of last year. And the dollar, relative to a lot of currencies, forget the dollar index, because nobody cares about Swedish kronas anyhow. The dollar is weak against a lot of currencies. Even the Canadian loonie rallied in the last week. I get kind of upset at that, Jim, because we're set right now for gold to do very well.
So given this market right now, as we talked about in the ag sector, Ned, some of the fertilizer stocks, there's probably a lot of production out there. It's kind of like what's happening in oil. And some of these equipment makers may be disappointing. So as you look at something and you think that there's a possibility that gold can take off, what could go wrong with your scenario? In other words, something else happens and gold doesn't go up and commodities go down.
I can't think of anything, Jim. I mean, it takes one of two kinds of events, an economic event that nobody foresees that's good. And I think the odds of us having a white swan out there in economic growth is got to be zero. And some political event that is a positive. I don't see that happening. So I don't see how gold could be hurt. I don't see anything that could happen to make gold go down. In the ag commodities, it would have to be something that crushes demand in the developing nations, because this is being driven on the ground with real transactions. In other words, when I talk about prices, I'm not talking about phony futures. I'm talking about cash prices people are paying for hogs and beef and wheat today on the ground, real transactions. So I don't see anything that could crush global demand from the developing nation. So I'm more optimistic now about the next year than I've probably been in 5 years.
All right. So you don't see anything on the negative side. Given where the state of the markets are and the possibility the Fed starts to tighten its balance sheet, if you had money and not in particular specific stocks, what would you be buying at this point?
Well, I would definitely own some gold. And one alternative, and I've never recommended it, but I'm leaning toward it because it's diversified and it avoids people buying any, you know, one stock and it being the one that's going to go down, is MOO, M-O-O-O, the ETF. That may be the safest way for an individual to participate in agricultural commodities. I think we've already seen it, and I think it will continue. We're going to see continued rotation in the market. because of Federal Reserve policy, away from technology stocks into basically other. Anything but that is where that's going. So that's my view.
Well, listen, Ned, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
I have two websites. One is the ValueViewGoldReport.com, and the other is AgriFoodValueView.com.
Well, surprise, surprise, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates this week. Well, actually, it probably wasn't. Maybe we should say, no surprise, no surprise, the Fed raised interest rates. Third time in a row, second time this year. Again, what does that mean? Because the things that would cause the Fed to do that type of action don't seem to be in existence right now. We have just the opposite. As a matter of fact, we have a slowing economy and falling inflation. And they keep talking about normalizing monetary policy, maybe around what, 4.5%, 5%, and also about balance sheet contraction. Is all of this really possible to do? And if it is possible, what does that mean for investors, since we know that the Fed usually does something until something else breaks, and then they say, oops, we have gone too far. We'll talk about that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.